history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some heroes around you. There are some seemingly ordinary Americans who have extraordinary stories to tell. And each week on this program, we have the chance to listen to them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And lately, we've been hearing from a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors as we count down to the 75th anniversary of that date, which has lived in infamy. And we're going to meet another Pearl Harbor survivor today. If you live in California's gold country, maybe you read about him in Friends and Neighbors magazine. Ski Bernacki, although I don't think your birth certificate says ski. What does it say on that birth certificate?
My real name is Chester. Middle name Joseph, but there's very few people that like to be called Chester because of the old days, the comic strip, for one example, and then, what do you call it, that Western, the guy with the limp.
Chester from Gunsmoke?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Well, and, you know, speaking of comic strips, my middle name is Abner, so I can, you know, commiserate with you.
Hi, Abner.
So they started calling you Ski just because of your ethnic heritage?
Well, after I joined the Navy, most of the Polish names were difficult to announce, or you know, it was easier to say Ski than a big, long Polish name.
Uh-huh.
So it just hung on to me, Ski.
And you grew up in Massachusetts, the son of two parents who had immigrated from Poland.
Yes.
Polish was your first language?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My mother and father came over in the 1890s, I think. My mother came over in 1909, I think, and my father came over before that. My brother was born in 13, and I was born in 22. And my father participated in World War I.
Uh-huh.
He went over with the Polish-American Army, and he come back. He was kind of followed up with they used to call it, what, shell shock in them days?
Yeah.
War neurosis in my time, now
PTSD.
Yeah.
And I want to hear what you remember about your father and if he told you any stories about that. But I'm just curious as I think about you speaking Polish growing up. Now, when I say Ski Bernacki, am I saying that the way they'd say it in Poland?
Or would say absolutely not. No,
I didn't think so.
It used to be Trzesław Józef Biernacki.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
You just make it easier on us Anglophones.
So when I started school, they changed Trzesław to Chester.
Uh-huh.
And then Bernacki.
So you're growing up in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yes.
During the Great Depression.
Well, I was in that too, yeah.
What do you remember about those days?
Oh, I can remember going through the pea soup lines. Still to this day, you can't get a good bowl of pea soup like I used to have in them days. A loaf of bread and a bucket of pea soup, take home with you at noon. I used to go through the pea soup line and they'd ask you, how many are you in your family? And I'd raise my hand, like three or four, and that's how many scoops of pea soup you used to get back east.
You think it was really better soup, or you think it just tasted better because that's all you had?
Absolutely better.
Do you remember having some dreams, some ambitions as that young boy, what you thought you were going to do with your life?
The first thing I thought about was joining the Coast Guard, because they had a Coast Guard cutter in New Bedford station there. It was called, would you believe, the Tahoe?
Huh.
And one day I used to go crabbing up underneath the piers there in New Bedford, and I reached inside the porthole of the Tahoe and stole my first sailor hat.
How about that? How old do you think you were?
Oh, I had to be 10, 11, 12, something right in there.
Uh-huh. And who knew what a sailor hat would see on your head through 20 years in the Navy, not the Coast Guard?
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a story there, but I don't want to forget to ask you about your father. You mentioned that he went over and fought in World War I. Did he ever tell you any stories about what he did over there?
Well, I was young, very young, when my mother and father broke up because of his problems, I guess, with drinking and stuff. I'm being honest about this.
That were a direct result of what he experienced in the war.
Yeah, that's what I think happened. Uh-huh. You know? My mother and father broke up, and then I didn't see my dad until I was about 16 or 17. He moved to the western part of Massachusetts, up around Adams and Hayden, in Haydenville County, from what I know. But then my father passed away, in, I guess, in 42, and my mother remarried, and I had a stepfather, which I hardly knew, being in the service.
Yeah, you were halfway around the world while all that was happening.
Yeah, a lot of time.
You've got this Coast Guard cutter there in New Bedford. You steal a sailor hat from it. And you had ideas about getting into the Coast Guard, but they didn't want you?
What happened is it was four of us decided to go up there. We got inside of a 34 Ford, and we went up to Charleston Navy out of Boston. And they examined all four of us, and a fella who we nicknamed the colonel, because his last name was Mosakovsky. And him and I were the only ones they would even consider taking, because we only had two teeth that had to be filled.
Uh-huh.
So they refused you until you get your teeth filled. So I went back, and then over time, and then all of a sudden I said, hell with that, I'm going to try the Navy. So I went up there, and I got my examination. I went home, and they called me. In the meantime, I got spiked playing baseball, sliding in the second base.
Uh-huh.
And when I got up there, I still had a little patch on my leg here, right here where I got spiked. And after I got examined, the doctor looked at me, said, what's that patch down there? And I told him, he says, go on back home until it's well and you're well enough to come back up here. I said, I can't come all the way up here. It's 52 miles from New Bedford to Boston. He said, well, why don't you go to Brockton, to the recruiting station there? So that's what I did. And I went up there, and then he said, go on home, we'll call you. So that's when I got called. I went back in. I went back up to Boston on August the 1st, 1940,
uh-huh.
is when I joined. I had my first bowl of beans, Navy beans, there in the post office building.
So you had to try three times to get into the service.
Yeah.
Why was that so important to you? Why did you want to do that so badly?
I don't know. I just wanted to get away from my brother mostly, because he used to beat the heck out of me, because he was more the, my mother said, well, okay, you won't do what you're told, I'll tell your brother,
uh-huh.
you know.
And he was 9 years older than you, so.
Yeah. And when I was real young, he used to have to pull me around the wagon, and he didn't like that very much. You know, my mother said, take care of your brother. And he wanted to go with the gang, you know.
Sure. You know, I know we're bouncing all over the place, but you talk about playing baseball. You're a baseball player growing up in the shadow of the Boston Red Sox in Fenway Park, which is still there.
Now you're going to remind me about listening to the Atwater Kent battery-operated radios.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Who was your favorite player?
Oh, and those, I don't, Babe Ruth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Before he joined the Yankees. My brother worked for a place called Standard Electric, and he got enough parts to build his radio and a set of earphones, and we'd turn them. He'd listen one ear, and I'd listen the other. In the meantime, my mother would be on Saturdays, mostly on Saturdays, we'd listen to ball games. And on Saturday, my mother always made a big pot of vegetable soup. And not being able to speak well in English, she used to say, okay, boys, baseball zupa. So that was our lunch.
Uh-huh.
Boston has always been my favorite team.
Did you have ambitions that maybe you were good enough to play baseball?
I wasn't that good. I played for the Sportsman's AC at one time for a short time, and I was too slow.
I know the feeling. So you finally get into the Navy, August 1940. What did you think you were going to do?
I had no idea. I was just glad I got into service, and I was enjoying it. I really did. I went through boot training there, and after I completed my training, I went home on leave. And when I came back, waiting to be assigned, I lived aboard the Constellation, the sister ship to the Ironsides.
All right.
Awaiting orders and transfer to the West Coast. And I slept in there. Those overheads were so low you had to bend over. You slept in hammocks 10 days. You had it and lived out of a sea bag.
Uh-huh.
Because you had no lockers and stuff. But I think I was in, I lived on the Constellation for about 3 weeks. And then they assembled a bunch of sailors and stuff and whatnot. And we got aboard a troop train and started out from the East Coast all the way to across. I remember one thing, Oklahoma, if I can tell you about this. Winoka, Oklahoma, we pulled in there, the train did, for taking on coal or water or whatever it was. And we were in the station there. And as we pulled out, there was a truck loaded with watermelons, and we lowered the windows in the passenger cars, and that truck drove alongside and was handing us watermelons through the window. And we proceeded on to San Pedro. We got to San Pedro, we got off the train, and we went down to the fleet landing and aboard more launches, and they took us out to the fleet. The cruisers and destroyers and battleships were all out there getting ready to go to Pearl Harbor. And when I got aboard ship to be assigned, years ago my brother told me, he says, if you're going to join the service, don't volunteer for nothing. And so they had us up on a forecastle, and they were asking different questions. Have you ever did this? You ever did that? You ever worked in a restaurant and stuff like that? And as you did, they pulled you out of the ranks and told you you were assigned to this division. You're assigned to this division. And the guys that were left over were put in a deck force. So that's how I ended up in a deck force. Anyway, we got underway and went to Pearl. And
this was on the Helena?
Yeah, on
board. Got on it at San Pedro.
Yeah.
Tell us about that ship. This is a pretty big ship.
Oh, yeah. It was 608 feet long and so many feet wide. It had four screws, two engine rooms, two fire rooms.
Was that kind of exciting to be on a ship like that?
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed being in the service. I really did, honestly.
Did you have any inkling that war was coming?
Oh, no, not at the beginning. Everything was fine and dandy. You used to go down to Fort DeRussy, play handball, go to Nanakuli Beach, and the auditorium out there by Diamond Head, swimming in that big Olympic-sized, bigger than, I guess, an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
You swam in there, in that auditorium?
Yeah, a lot of times. I'd go on the beach, and being a seaman, you always had to get back by 12 o'clock. They used to call it Cinderella Liberties. And you couldn't stay on the beach overnight, you know.
Yeah, that's one of those pieces of history that's still there. They still have that natatorium there along the coastline, and you can tell that it's pretty old.
Yeah, Kaneohe, and I remember the old Polly.
So this was quite a life for the kid from Massachusetts out here in paradise.
I was living it up. Yeah, go down to Waikiki Beach and walk around, because I don't want to get into going down to what we did down on 4th Street.
I'm sure our imaginations can come up with a few ideas. I've heard a few stories. Was there a line out the door?
Let's not get into that.
And what kinds of things were you doing there at Pearl Harbor before the attack, in the weeks and months leading up to that?
What I remember about it, we did a lot of training. I was assigned a 5-inch 38 battery.
Yeah.
And I was a shellman. And so we practiced. It's semi-fixed ammunition. I was a shellman, and the shells weighed 60 pounds each, and there was a powderman and a trainer, pointer, and a captain, and we had a lot of training every day. The guy that really stands out in my mind, it was Jungle Jim Baird. What a heck of a guy he was. He was a lieutenant, and Lieutenant Chu.
As a shellman on this 5-inch 38 gun mount, which is a huge gun, where you've got multi-levels of people that are working on it.
These 5-inch 38s on Helena and the St. Louis were mounts. On the Nashville and some of the other cruisers were open mounts, and they were 5-inch 25s, if I remember right.
Explain to us what that means as a shellman. What did you have to do?
Well, what I did is I waited for the powderman to put the casing in the gun, and then I took the projectile out of the fuse box, the hoist, which came up from the upper handling room.
So you've got guys a level below you who are sending these shells up.
Yeah.
You grab it
and
put it in.
Yeah.
And then they fire it.
Yeah.
What does that sound like?
Well, you didn't hear too much inside the mount. Most of the noise was outside.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know what it would be like with the open mount, you know. Then we had the 6-inch battery. That was the main battery, the 6-inch.
Mm-hmm.
We had three turrets.
So you guys practiced this quite a bit.
At least 3 or 4 times a week.
You know, there's a particular Sunday morning that I'm interested in hearing about, December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day?
If I can start out this way, the night before, I went ashore with a couple of buddies of mine. We got back at 12 o'clock. I told you about that Cinderella Liberty. And this one buddy, real good buddy of mine, Charlie Cioffi, had the duty that day, so he was on the quarterdeck. Had the duty from 8 to 12. And I woke up in the morning. I did my thing, and then I had breakfast, and I decided I'd go ashore. So I went down to Foot Locker, and I broke out my shoes and put another buffing on them, and I was sitting there, and I got an uncomfortable feeling. And I said, I think I'll go topside and have a smoke. So as I started up the ladder, the general quarters alarm sounded, and it says, all hands manage your battle stations. Not knowing what the heck was going on, I dropped everything, which you were trained to do, and I headed for my mount, my battle station. And just as I got inside the mount, there was a big explosion. And I figured, what the hell's going on here, you know? We manned the mount, and they reported to sky aft, went into director control, and we started firing. From what I understand, I think we were the first ship to get hit. It came over Ford Island toward the 1010 dock that we were tied up at, in place of the Pennsylvania, which should have been there, but the Pennsylvania had moved forward into the dry dock.
Right.
Which was ahead of us.
And when you say there was an explosion, I want to make it clear for people listening, you're not talking about an explosion on another ship. You're talking about an explosion on your ship that you felt.
Oh, yeah, the ship just shook, and I didn't know what was happening. You know, who would think you were going to be in the start of a war?
Right.
You know, but like I say, being we had so much training that everything fell into place. You did things automatically without even thinking.
And I want to ask about something else you said there, too. You know, you said that you were going to go ashore, and then you got an uneasy feeling. Premonition that something was wrong, or what?
I don't know what it was. I really don't. Honestly, I'm being honest. I said, I think I'll just go up topside and have a cigarette, you know. And as I did, the announcing system from the quarterdeck are telling us, man your battle stations. So being trained like we were, everybody headed for what they were supposed to do. And what was bad about it is it happened so fast that we didn't have time to set the damage control all over the ship. So when we got hit, we got hit in the forward fire room, between the forward fire room and the forward engine room. Just put a big gaping hole in the side, and she just settled there at the dock, which wasn't very deep, you know, just deep enough to in and out.
Right. So if you guys would have been hit in the same spot on the ship but been in deeper water, it would have been a much different scenario.
Well, that's another story about Kula Gulf.
Yeah, we're going to get to that, the end of your ship,
yeah,
which is no longer with us, at least not on the surface anywhere. So December 7th, this morning, you get to that battle station, and you're loading these shells, loading shell after shell after shell, I would imagine. But you can't see anything, right?
No, because we're inside the mount.
So you have no idea what's happening out there.
I had no idea. And then all of a sudden, I forget how long we were firing, but then we had a lull. And we were told to go outside, clear the casings off the deck, throw them over on the dock, and cut the awnings down, because we had awnings, frilled awnings, you know, up over the bow and the quarter deck and stuff. We had to get that canvas off the ship so it wouldn't catch fire and stuff and whatnot.
It's time to take our first break, but we'll go back to December 7th, 1941, when we come back with a man who was there, 94-year-old Ski Bernacki of Jamestown, California. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends and access access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 94-year-old Chester Ski Bernacki of Jamestown, California, originally from New Bedford, Massachusetts, but on December 7th, 1941, he was on the light cruiser USS Helena at Pearl Harbor. We heard him describe the explosion he felt from within his 5-inch 38 gun mount when the Helena was struck with a torpedo that morning. And when we left off, he was out on the deck helping to clean things up after the first wave of Japanese planes had come and gone. But I'm guessing you guys had no idea whether or not there were more on the way.
Yeah, we didn't know that, but like I say, when I went outside to throw those casings and to clear the decks, I looked over toward Battleship Row, and all you could see was this smoke and the mortar launches and tugs running around picking up survivors and stuff. It was off in the distance,
right?
You know, but you could just see turmoil, black smoke rising. And at the time, if I remember right, when I looked over there, I thought I saw the Oklahoma capsizing. So then all of a sudden, here we come again, back in the mount, started shooting again.
So you're a 19-year-old kid. You come up to the top of your ship in this paradise that you've been enjoying for a while.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And this is what you see. How mind-blowing was that to look at that?
I don't know how to explain it. What the heck's going on? You know, even right now, I can't imagine how I felt.
Was it, I guess, opposite ends of that spectrum would be, on one hand, it could be a punch to the gut that makes you really emotional, and on the other hand, just so shocking that you're almost numb to it and you don't even know what's going on. Was it somewhere in between that?
Even right now, I can remember a lot of stuff that happened, you know, looking over this way and seeing this happen and that happen. I remember after the attack, more or less, I looked over to my right, and there was a smokestack there that we had a shot a hole through it and knocked an airplane down on the other side. And this guy, Wally Wallings, was in that tower, and I think he said something about, what the heck are you guys doing shooting at? Because it's pretty close to that stack, you know,
yeah.
From what I heard, you know.
And again, you have no idea what you're shooting at, because all you're doing personally is stuffing
I'm
the shells
in. I'm putting those projectiles in and going as fast as I could.
Maybe this is an obvious question or a dumb question, but that probably has to get pretty exhausting after a while, because those are 60-pound shells that you're picking up and dropping in.
You don't even notice it. When you're doing something that you can do it, baby. I used to be in pretty good shape there.
Yeah, that's a good-looking sailor over there on the wall there. I'll take a picture of that and put it at hometownheroesradio.com. And the sailor you just mentioned, Wally Walling, was just on this show and told that story from his perspective, and I think he's forgiven you for trying to shoot him in the tower.
I hope so.
You guys will see each other at Pearl Harbor for the 75th anniversary,
yeah,
hopefully.
I hope that happens too, and I hope old Chase is with us.
Yeah, Chase Anderson wrote stories on both of these gentlemen for Friends and Neighbors magazine. I have that linked at hometownheroesradio.com too. So you get out there on the deck, you got to clean up, but you're looking around and you see just devastation everywhere. And you probably have no idea who did it, right?
Oh, yeah. They let us know right off the bat.
They told you.
Oh, yeah.
So you knew it was the Japanese and this is war.
Oh, man, I'll tell you. After the attack and them guys went over to get burned and stuff, you could smell the flesh from at the hospital when the wind changed and blew over the harbor. They moved us into dry dock and it was a new dry dock they were building at the time. It hadn't even been completed. But we got in there and they closed the case on and didn't have any facilities, you know, for this and that. And we had to do our stuff outside over the top of a 2x4.
What about when the second wave of planes came in?
All I remember is we just kept shooting. You know, you don't think about what's happening. You're just doing it. You've had so much training, I guess. And then after the battle was over and the whole bit like that, everybody was trigger happy. They sent us sandwiches to eat, and we kept everything manned. That night there was supposed to be some planes or something coming in, which a lot of people didn't know about.
You mean American planes?
Yeah, American planes. And everybody was trigger happy, so they had these machine gun mounts on top of buildings and all, and all you could hear is every once in a while somebody would test, you know, da 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 da. Then at the end of the harbor, you hear the same thing. Da-da-da-da-da. When the planes came in that night, somebody opened up a little too long, so the other guy took over and they just kept shooting until I heard they knocked down five of the planes.
Well, and you can understand what you describe as being trigger happy. I mean, because you guys have no idea what to expect now. The world has changed in a day, and I'm sure you heard and probably wondered, are the Japanese coming here? Is this going to be an invasion? What's going to happen next? Yeah. Do you remember wondering what was going to happen?
Honestly, I can't remember. I can't remember how I felt about it. All I know is I knew Charlie saw if he got injured. Because when the flare of the torpedo went up through the ventilation system, it come out through the exhaust, which was over the top of the quarterdeck, and I understand he got burned and he ended up in the hospital. That was the last time I saw Charlie.
See, he's one of your good buddies, and you find out he's been burned from head to toe.
Yeah, and like I say, he ended up in the hospital. I never heard from about him after that.
Here you are. This has all happened. You know your ship is damaged. You know people have died. And one of your best buddies is burned so bad it burned all the clothes off of him.
Yeah, just give you a shirt, yeah.
What did that do to you, to know and see things like that?
Well, see, I didn't see that, but I heard about what happened to Charlie.
Yeah.
That he got burned, and the guys that did get burned, to start out with, we used to have inspections, right? They wore full uniform, the whites. And then Eleanor Roosevelt come over before Pearl Harbor, and had everybody send in three sets of whites and cut them down to where they looked like the Bermudas, you know, the shorts. And that was a bad thing because when the guys got burned and stuff like that, the skin was exposed.
Yeah.
I can remember the first inspection that we had wearing them new outfits. We were up on a quarterdeck and the captain, Max Dietermore, went through the lines in two ranks, facing forward, and then the front rank about facing, and they have the inspection, you know. So as soon as that first rank did an about face and we were facing one another, everybody looked at their faces first and then they went down. Everybody had big tans and they got down to the legs, they were white, some of them were like toothpicks. They were big pot bellies, and I don't think there was anybody smiling or laughing like Helen. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. But like I say, that exposure of the skin was a big thing. Mm-hmm. On them burned guys. Wherever the thickness was on a skivvy shirt, it was less burned with.
Sure.
Then, you know.
So there are guys that are burned. There are guys that are hit by projectiles, the shrapnel. And as I read in Chase's article, you saw a guy who was hurt pretty severely on one of the gun mounts, right?
What happened is one of the guys, he was in a turret 2. And in order to get into turret 2, which was higher than the turret 1, mm-hmm. you had to climb up a ladder to get up inside the turret. Mm-hmm. As he was reaching up into the ladder to climb up, some kind of fragment or something hit that barbette and hit him in the chest and tore his arm off. So they put him on the beach. And then when we had the canvas out there, we took the awnings down, he was inside of one of those awnings.
With his whole arm blown off.
Yeah, dead in a doornail.
And you saw that?
Yeah, that's the only time I ever saw anything like that that was real bad, except when I was in Guam and it's all the Japanese dead bodies and stuff and whatnot.
So seeing all of this, is that something that makes you angry? Are you just sad? How would you describe the emotions that stirred up in you?
I don't know how it affected me, honestly. Like I say, I guess I was going into what they call that post-traumatic deal. Because I got to where I just didn't give a rat's butt, you know, about anything. I just did what I thought I was supposed to be doing.
What about the days and weeks that followed the attack? What were you guys doing?
Well, what happened after the attack, and we were able to, they put us in the dry dock. and they patched the hole in the hull. And then we went back to Vallejo, and they took all the machine guns off, and they put 1.1s on, and then 40 millimeters. When we were well enough that they thought that we were able to go out, we stopped in Pearl and on our way to Guadalcanal, the South Pacific. And we met up with a ship from the East Coast, I think it was the Brazil. We were escorting, I think, the Long Island escort carrier with reinforcements of fighter planes, F4Us for the Marines on Guadalcanal. And we got there just right after the first battle of Guadalcanal, where the Quincy Vincennes Astoria and the Canberra were sunk.
Uh-huh.
We had an advanced base called Espirito Santo. We went down there, and then we operated out of there, in and out. The next thing that I can remember is September the 15th, we were operating with the Wasp. She got hit. It was on a payday, September the 15th.
1942,
yeah.
And this is another one of the great tragedies of World War II. Yeah. What happened to the USS Wasp?
Well, she got torpedoed. We were one of the escorts in the group, and we circled and circled, and the guys went over the side, and some of them guys went over the side being payday. When they dropped the charges, you look over the side, and you could see money rolling around.
Huh.
I remember that because we went outside. You didn't use the 6-inch battery. You could use 5-inch battery for surface fire to disrupt, say, a torpedo coming in, if you could aim at it,
right,
and stuff like that. But that was my first real big experience after that, September the 15th.
So you see a ship that got torpedoed and is sinking, and you see basically the entire crew of the ship going overboard and in the water. And did you guys pick up some of those guys?
I think we picked up 400 guys that day.
And I'm just wondering, as you are witnessing the destruction of another ship, and your ship's already been hit once, and you're picking up guys, well, you were hit at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
You're picking up guys from a sinking ship. Does it ever occur to you that that could happen to you someday, that you might find yourself in that position?
Heck, I told you, heck no. we thought we were invincible.
Uh-huh.
The fighting lady, oh, God.
Little did you know.
Next thing that I can remember is in October, the first battle at Cape Esperance, we opened up in a night battle. All these battles took place at night.
Sometimes like 1 or 2 in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cape Esperance, we used our searchlights, which was a no-no. And then some of the guys up on the searchlight, we got hit in the stacks.
You said you turned the searchlights on, and maybe some people aren't connecting the dots. The reason that was a bad idea is now the Japanese know where you are.
Yeah, expose yourself, see?
And then you guys got hit.
Yeah. The next battle, night engagement we were in was the Battle of Guadalcanal. It lasted for 3 days. We went in with a bunch of troop ships to land on Guadalcanal. That was in the afternoon. What I remember about, we got a warning that the Japanese Air Force was coming down from, I think, Munda or someplace up north. And so they took the troop ships and moved them out of the slot. And we just waited for them to come in. There was 13 of us ships that day, 5 cruisers and 8 destroyers, tin cans. When they came in, I think, we shot down 32 of them, something like that. And I think we were credited with 5 of them. After that, we hung around because we heard the Japanese fleet was coming down that night. I don't know how many ships we fought against that night. And that's when the Atlanta and the Juno, the Atlanta got sunk. The Juno, which had the 5 Sullivan brothers on it, and the San Francisco got hit real bad. And we were on our way back to Espirito Santo after the battle, and we run into a nest of submarines, I guess it was. They fired, and I heard that the torpedo went by us and hit the Juno, and the Juno just disintegrated.
Uh-huh.
Part of the Juno, I understand, the hull flew through the air and hit the San Francisco. And I think our captain was reprimanded, is that the word, for not sticking around, which would have been stupid. He says, yeah, let's get the heck out of here, you know.
And you mentioned the Sullivan brothers. But so then, on the Juno, there were 5 of them. They all died.
That has
become a kind of a legendary thing in the armed forces. They named a ship after the Sullivan brothers, but they changed the policy.
Yeah, not to have too many brothers or relatives on the same ship.
Right.
I think our ship radioed And they sent a search plane of, you know, Catalina flying boats, PBYs, back there to see what was still left.
And all this is happening, and you still think you're invincible?
Yes. I'm still here, aren't I?
Yes, you are. And you're in great shape for almost 95. Was there ever a point where that air of invincibility was rocked a little bit, where you started to think, you know, something like this could claim my life?
No. Honestly, no. I took it day by day, you might say.
Well, there is one day that I'm really going to have to ask you about, the day your ship was sunk and you had to survive in the water. When we come back, we'll go back to July 6, 1943, and the Battle of Kula Gulf. Remember, you can find photos and video of this spirited 94-year-old at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, it is hard to forget the story of Jimmy Weldon, or as so many of us first heard him, the voice of that little duck on the Yogi Bear show, Yakky Doodle.
Help! Chopper! Chopper, you're after me!
Run, little feller!
I'm running!
Yakky, now that you're safe, tell me, where's your mama?
I don't have no mama. Would you be my mama?
Yep, even in his 90s, he can still do that voice. And you can see and hear for yourself at a special lunch with Jimmy Weldon on Thursday, October 20th in Clovis, California. Maybe you grew up with Uncle Jimmy Weldon and Webster Webfoot on TV in places like Bakersfield, Monterey, Salinas, or Fresno. You'll be amazed at his journey from World War II in Europe all the way to Hollywood and everywhere in between. And you'll be moved by just how much he loves our country. Thursday, October 20th from noon to 1:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District building, a lunch you'll never forget with the one and only Jimmy Weldon. For tickets, go to cbmcfresno.com or call 559-225-5095. That number again, 559-225-5095. I'll be there and I hope to see you there October 20th in Clovis.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today spent 2 decades in the Navy. He even journeyed to the South Pole as part of Operation High Jump. But that opportunity never would have presented itself if Ski Bernacki hadn't survived more than an hour in the water after the sinking of his cruiser, the USS Helena, during the Battle of Kula Gulf in July 1943.
We bombarded that day, and then that night we were supposed to stop 10 destroyers from landing their troops. We had expended our armor piercing, and all we had left was bombardment ammunition that night. Flashless powder, you can't see it. The other powder.
The only powder you had was the one that was real obvious and visible.
That's what I'm trying to say,
Yeah.
So when we got into the Battle of Kula Gulf, we started firing and we exposed ourselves with all this light, you know. We sunk a couple of ships, and then we got hit. The first hit, it took the bow completely off. And I think we were doing 15, 20 knots, something like that. And being inside the mount, I don't see what's going on. You know, all I could do is feel things. Of course, we had a light inside the mount to see what we were doing. When we got hit and the bow got blown off, the ship just started quivering and shuddering from the motion of going forward. And then when we lay dead in the water, we got hit with 2 more. But right in the spot where we had been hit in Pearl Harbor.
Same spot.
Yeah, between the engine room and fire room of midships. All the lights went out. The gun captain says, abandon ship. So we got outside the mound, I did, and I reached for my life jacket, which was outside. You didn't wear your life jacket inside. No life jacket. So I got down, and being coming out of the light into the dark, you could hardly see anything real good, you know. So I got down on my hands and knees, and the teak wood decks were crackling. And next thing I knew, I was in the water. And I looked up, and I could see a silhouette of the two stacks kind of bending together. And I thought, I better get away from here. I was told, get away from the side of a ship if it's going down, because it might suck you underwater, you know. I swam away from the side of the ship, no life jacket. I looked around, what the heck am I going to do here, you know. Still looking around, and all of a sudden, I found a life raft. And I was really tired by then.
I bet.
From swimming. So I put my arms inside of the bales of line outside the life rings. You couldn't get inside because that was reserved for the wounded and stuff. So I hung there for a while, and then all of a sudden, here comes a life jacket, a Mae West. I put that on, got that on. I tied
it just floated
on.
Right to you.
Yeah, it was just floating around.
Uh-huh.
And then I found a pneumatic life jacket, which fitted around your waist, and used the CO2 bottle. I tried to put that on to have it inflate, but it was dead, so I just blew it up manually. So I had a life jacket around my gut, a pneumatic life jacket, and it Mae West. So then that's when I was comfortable being alongside, outside the life raft. And then I looked over and I saw, which I thought was a silhouette. So I said, I wonder what the hell that is. So I swam over that way. I didn't know whether it was Jap or what, but as I got close to it, it was the Radford. So as I got close to it to get aboard, the ship got underway, because the battle was still taking place.
Yeah.
And so it got underway, and here I am, you know, by myself out there in the water again. So I'm swimming around, and here comes the Nicholas. Fortunate enough, I got the head cargo nets over the side. I grabbed the cargo net, got on, and held on for dear life. I climbed up and got up underneath the torpedo tubes. The ship got underway and went down the other end of the harbor, still during the battle. I was close enough to where I saw the torpedo tube move when they shot it out. Anyway, the battle was still going on, and what I remember about the whole thing is loaded with crude oil, and the eyes burning, skin burning and stuff.
You were covered with oil from being in the water all that time.
Yeah, all that crude oil and stuff. They sent us down to the engine room. We got some of that light diesel, and that's what we cleaned off and took as good a shower as we could. And they gave us clothes, you know, dungarees and stuff, so we'd have something to wear. And as we pulled into Tulagi, it seemed like everybody on the shoreline and the ships and all, everybody got out and gave us a welcome and a salute, you know. And then they transferred me to the Honolulu with a bunch of guys. And then we got underway and went down to Espiritu Santo. And I stayed there with the 3rd Special Seabed Battalion till we got orders to come back to the States. And I think they put us on the Lew Wallace, a Liberty ship that was only built to make one trip. And coming back to the States, you could actually look out from inside the ship through the hull when the ship moved. You could just see the daylight outside.
You weren't sure you were going to make it on that thing,
huh? Oh, well, everybody was so happy. We had card games going, and everybody was trying to make a buck, you know.
So that night, Kula Gulf, how long were you in the water?
I keep telling myself 2 hours, but I don't think I was in there that long.
Somewhere between 1 and 2.
Yeah, you can't judge time. Oh, here's another thing. After it got sunk, you know, here I am in the water, and the first thing that comes to my mind is, what the hell is my mother going to say about this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in Pearl Harbor, they didn't notify. At first, I was missing, you know, and they notified her back east in Massachusetts.
So she got a telegram saying your son is missing after the attack on Pearl
Harbor. At
first,
yeah, and then found out that I was still around. While I was in the water and I was swimming around, and the first thing I thought about is I kicked my shoes off. I had my socks on. So here I'm paddling my feet, and they filled up, the socks filled up with water. And the first thing come to my mind is, boy, that thing looks like lures. I hope them sharks don't think the same thing.
Yeah. With white socks kicking
around? Yeah, white socks, yeah.
Did you see any sharks anywhere?
No. No, but it was on my mind.
Sure. You know, maybe this is a dumb question, or maybe you've never considered it before, but had that Mae West not floated by, or the life jacket not floated by, do you think the outcome would have been any different?
Only the guy upstairs knows. It wasn't my time, I guess.
Because you were already pretty exhausted.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, when I swimming without a life jacket, the water wasn't really rough, but it was rough enough to where it took a little effort. And then all this stuff going through your mind, you can't see. What the hell happened? You know, where's the ship? A lot of things went through my mind.
You mentioned your eyes burning, too, from getting oil and stuff.
Yeah, that crude oil is just like, almost like tar, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, real heavy, heavy crude.
This is a serious nightmare that you're living in.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything that went through your mind during that time?
Goofy things.
Yeah?
Where the hell's my wristwatch?
Maybe God didn't want you to know how long you were in the water.
That, and like I told you, what's my mom going to say about this? You know?
What did she say about it?
She was just happy that, because when I come back to the States, I went on survivor's leave and spent 30 days there. And then I came back to San Francisco and I went over to TI there, and I was going to be assigned to the Reno.
Hmm.
And I just come right out and told him, I says, you assigned me to Reno, I'm going over the hill. I'm not going aboard one of the AA cruises. The guy saw that Juno blow.
Mm-hmm.
That scared the hell out of me. So they put me on the next best thing, a minesweeper.
That's not dangerous.
Yeah, so then I went to the Santa Barbara State College, had a course in minesweeping there, and then Long Beach, Terminal Island. And at that time, Robert Montgomery was in charge down there, the actor.
Yeah?
Yeah, and then I went up to Portland, Oregon, and I picked up the caravan, AM-157.
So you mentioned coming home on survivor's leave. And the whole point of that is you've survived something. You've been through something that other guys did not survive. When did you find out about how many of your crewmates died, and were there any of your friends that went down with the ship?
When the Helena was sunk, there was a number of guys that got picked up by the destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a bunch of guys that clung to the bow of the Helena.
Right.
And then there was some guys that were in motor launches and stuff. And I think there was 100-some-odd guys that ended up on one of the islands over there. There's a long story about that, the rescue of them guys on that island.
Did you know any of the guys that died when the Helena sank?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Albanese. I think there was about 8 or 10 guys that I went through boot camp with.
Hmm. Well, and I guess the implication is that could have been you.
I guess, yeah, but like I say, it just wasn't my time. That guy upstairs had controls.
Do you ever think about that? I mean, you think about meeting your wife, having children. I see grandchildren in Air Force uniforms on the wall over here. None of them would have ever been born.
That's right, yeah. Like I say, yeah, I had my day. I was married twice, and then 48 years, Ellie and I were together, never had an argument, just best thing ever happened to me.
And none of that would have ever happened.
Yeah.
Guys were killed on your ship at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
A lot of them killed at Kula Gulf.
Yeah.
You had to survive in the water. Had that Mae West show up, the life jacket show up.
The Nicholas was my baby.
A lot of things had to go just right for you.
They did.
When you think back on that, what do you think was the closest call or the most amazing thing that you endured?
I really can't pinpoint anything. I just think that I was lucky. Lucky as heck.
I want to bring you back around to where a lot of this started. You were there at Pearl Harbor December 7th, 1941, and you were there in the 1950s, too. The last time you were there was 1956. So the 75th anniversary coming up on December 7th is going to be your first trip to the
back
USS
there.
Arizona Memorial.
Yeah, I never have been over in that part. I'd like very much to go down on the 1010 dock and put a wreath over the side, because I remember a lot of them guys.
What makes you want to go back?
I'll never get another chance at my age.
Yeah. What do you think that's going to be like?
Yeah, I guess a lot of stuff will come back into my mind. I'm fortunate that I can remember a lot of this stuff at my age.
You really are.
75 years ago, the rallying cry was, "Remember Pearl Harbor."
Yeah, that's another thing. You don't hear that very much.
No, we don't.
No, you don't.
But when you say it, it means something.
To me, it does, really. And when I think that people don't remember, it kind of upsets me.
What should we remember? For people that weren't alive then, that didn't experience it the way you did, what do we need to remember?
People have short memories. They're already forgetting 9/11.
Yeah.
They're already forgetting that.
So what is the lesson of Pearl Harbor? What can we take? What should we remember?
Remember Pearl Harbor, what happened and why it happened. You weren't alert.
One of the enduring images of Pearl Harbor, well, there's a few of them, but they involve the Stars and Stripes. You know, that Remember Pearl Harbor poster that went all over the country in the wake of the attack had a tattered flag flying among the smoke. Hickam Field had that flag on the pole. It's one of the most famous photos there. When you look at the flag now, what does it mean to you?
The population of the United States should have more respect for it, for one thing. And everybody should try to get into service and serve the country, man and woman. I don't go along with the idea of them being on the same ship together, because that could be awful distracting.
You saying you would have been distracted if you had women on your ship?
You better bet you. You better bet you. And even at this age, I'm not too behind schedule, I think.
There's something else that I want to say. I need to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling your story. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
That I was a member of the armed forces, the Navy, and the best ship I ever served on was the Helena. A lot of friends I made in the Navy, and the result of being in the Navy, I have a lot of friends now, like the guy right there.
Uh-huh.
And people I know that kind of give me a little respect, I think you might call it. And I'm glad that Chase is coming with me to Pearl Harbor if we go.
When you go, it's not too far away now. And Chase is Chase Anderson, a retired educator who has documented the stories of dozens of World War II veterans, including Mr. Bernacki. I've got links to Chase's work at hometownheroesradio.com, but I thought you'd like to hear from Chase on what he appreciates about his friend Ski.
For me, it's a treat to be in the presence of people who saw Ed and did things I only read about. And the fact that he was at Pearl Harbor always moves me. And he's a good guy. I have an incredible respect, admiration, and affection for that generation because my parents were part of it.
Mm-hmm. With Ski in particular, is there an element of his story that is the most amazing to you?
Probably the sinking in Kula Gulf. I mean, he shared with you some of the particulars, but if I place myself on a ship on a dark night in the South Pacific that has been torpedoed and I'm cast in the water, for me, that would be so terrifying. I think that's probably the part of his war experience and his life experience that seems most remarkable to me. But I also appreciate and understand what he said in the interview about training and training and training, so that when that sinking occurred in Kula Gulf and the attack occurred at Pearl Harbor, he didn't spend a lot of time introspectively saying, what is happening and what is my reaction to it? He had been trained, and so he followed his training and he did a job. And that's what so many did during the war that I think we're all appreciative of and respect that attitude.
Hard to say it any better than that. We're out of time here on the radio, but if you pull up the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find more from Ski Bernacki and more from Chase Anderson about how he got into telling veteran stories and why it's so important. Who knows? Maybe you'll be inspired to take a little initiative with the veterans in your life. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Talking about ski, you've interviewed, recorded the stories of quite a few veterans. What stands out to you about Ski, who he is, and his story?
He's a great guy, for one thing. It's amazing to me that somebody who is on the cusp of turning 95 is as sharp as he is and has the memory that he does. But the other unique thing about him is that he has memories of perhaps the most iconic day in 20th century history. He was there. He was at Pearl Harbor. So for me, it's a treat to be in the presence of people who saw Ed and did things I only read about. And the fact that he was at Pearl Harbor always moves me. And he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had a good time getting to know him.
Yeah, it's been fascinating over the years of doing this program to meet people in different parts of the country who are preserving history, who are getting veterans to tell their stories, oftentimes stories that were never told. How did you get started doing this?
I live in Sonora, and I retired 5 years ago from Sonora High School and knew that I would have some time to do things I hadn't done before and looked around at some volunteer opportunities. And there was a group in Tuolumne County called the Tuolumne Veterans History Project. At the time, they had interviewed and recorded the stories of six local World War II veterans. Their aim was to record stories before they were lost, and the motive was to record them for the families of those veterans. I had an interest in World War II. My father was a veteran and died before I really got to know his story, so I wanted to help others preserve theirs. So I volunteered, and I began interviewing local Tuolumne County World War II veterans, and like a few other volunteers with the group, we would write their stories from a first-person point of view as if they were telling them themselves from birth until the current time, but focus about 70% of it on the war years. And then with the help of a local printing company who did it at cost, we published their stories in small booklets for their families, and the veteran would receive a few copies. And we also posted them online. In 2011, when I began, they had done six, and we've just finished our 60th.
Outstanding.
And all of them are online at memoircenter.com. Should anybody be interested in reading them. The only two requirements were that the veterans be Tuolumne County residents and have served in some capacity during World War II. Three of those 60 are women, lighthouse keeper, a wave. We've had veterans who saw incredible combat, and we have veterans who had desk jobs. All of them made a significant contribution, and all deserve to have their stories preserved.
So 5 years later, you're still doing this work, and a lot of your stories have also appeared in Friends and Neighbors magazine, including the gentleman we heard today. Why are you still doing it 5 years later? You must enjoy it. You must get something out of it.
The people are incredible. I have met some amazing men and women. It began working for the Tuolumne Veterans History Project, and another volunteer happened to be the editor of Friends and Neighbors magazine, which serves Tuolumne, Calaveras, and Amador counties. And she had asked if I would be willing to write some articles for the magazine, and that's how I moved over there. And the subjects of those articles usually are veterans, but they're all members of that generation, whether they were in the war or not. And I've probably interviewed close to 40 people in those 5 years, and I have an incredible respect, admiration, and affection for that generation because my parents were part of it. My mom was born in 1920 and my dad in 1919, so they fit right in. Ski is an example of a really strong individual. Almost without exception, all of the people I've interviewed, who have ranged in age from 58 to 101, are strong individuals with great characters, especially the World War II veterans. And that's why I suppose I keep doing it. I learned something, and it feels good also to share their stories with other people.
And know that their families, unlike your situation where you don't know all the details of your dad's service, that their families will, at least whatever they're willing to share. And I would guess that in doing all these interviews, you probably feel like you have learned a little more about your father or the kinds of things that he might have gone through.
I have. I've become a student of World War II, and I've been able to make a number of connections that I hadn't made before. 3 years ago, I found his service number, and I knew his Social Security number, so I applied to the military archives for all of his records. It took about 2 months before I heard from them, but 182 pages of documents on my father's military career arrived, and I was able to put a lot of his movement through the South Pacific in 1944 and 45 together from what they sent me. I was 9 years old when I was in the ninth grade when he died. I was 14. So like so many members of that generation, he had always been reluctant to share details and had kept a lot of it to himself. So I didn't know firsthand what he had done, but I've been able to piece it together partly through the things I've done the last 5 years with World War II veterans. I made a trip last November to New Orleans to see the World War II Museum, spent a couple days there with my wife, and that was a wonderful experience, and I learned a great deal there too. So I just enjoy doing it.
And I don't want to be melodramatic or put words in your mouth, but I'm just wondering, as I hear you share that, do you think if he had not passed as early as he did without telling you anything, if that wasn't the reality, do you think you would have taken on this challenge of doing what you're doing now?
I'm sure some of my motivation was a desire to learn more about his story, and the fact that it was never preserved. It was a motivation to preserve the stories of others. And I wonder, had he lived, to the age that Ski is, or a few of these other guys that I've interviewed, might he have been less reluctant to share some of those details? I know I've approached a few veterans about sharing their stories, and their families have said, no way, he doesn't talk about it, he won't talk about it, he hasn't told us, and he won't talk to you. And through introducing the topic gently and doing it in a non-threatening way, some of them have opened up in ways that their families told me they had never opened up before. And I think it's not me, I think it's the fact that they've reached a period in their lives or a certain age where they are confronting their mortality, perhaps, but they realize that if their story isn't told sooner or later, it never will be. And so I can think of four or five men who were very stoic and didn't speak about their war experience for 60 years, did so in the last five, often to the surprise of their families.
That's about the most satisfying feeling to experience that, to see what it means to their family. I certainly identify with that. With Ski in particular, is there an element of his story that is the most amazing to you?
Probably the sinking in Kula Gulf. I mean, he shared with you some of the particulars, but if I place myself on a ship on a dark night in the South Pacific that has been torpedoed and I'm cast in the water, for me, that would be so terrifying. I think that's probably the part of his war experience and his life experience that seems most remarkable to me. But I also appreciate and understand what he said in the interview about training and training and training, so that when that sinking occurred in Kula Gulf and the attack occurred at Pearl Harbor, he didn't spend a lot of time introspectively saying, what is happening and what is my reaction to it? He had been trained, and so he followed his training and he did a job. And that's what so many did during the war that I think we're all appreciative of and respect that attitude.
Amen.
Oh, yeah. We went down to New Caledonia for a rest period after that Battle of Guadalcanal. And South Dakota was in there, which she had been in a real big air battle. And she had been hit quite a bit. And we were in Noumea, New Caledonia, on R&R. We had a few things we had to take care of, too. And then they decided to give us a little R&R. So they picked up, I think it was 200 free French, Polynesians or Tahitians or whatever they were. Mm-hmm. Big men, wore gun belts across their chest, wore those French tams, and they berthed them in the hangar deck. And the bakers actually went crazy because every one of them that sat down ate a whole loaf of bread. And they wore their shoes around their neck on the ship. And how they could walk across those decks above the engine room and the fire room is beyond me, because even with a regular pair of shoes on, you had to hurry up.
It was that hot.
It was that hot. Yeah. But them guys with their feet as wide as mine are long.
Uh-huh.
Big. I'm talking about big men. And we took them to Sydney, Australia, and they were supposed to go on forward for the invasion of South Africa. General Rommel and all that.
Yeah, North Africa. Yeah, this is still very early in the war. Did you ever hear from home at all during all that time?
Yeah, I heard from my brother, my mom, you know. I had a couple of girlfriends I corresponded with.
Only a couple?
Yes. Yes, that's what I said. Max B. DeMont and Captain Cecil and them guys are number one in my book on the Helena. But Cecil E. Walden was my captain on this caravan.
Where'd you guys go?
We did a lot of escort duty and pilot duty in Kwajalein, Eniwetok, and Guam, Saipan, Tinian, Peleliu, Castle Roads, Guam, what else? Majuro.
And what was your duty on that ship?
I was a boatswain mate, topside. I was first class and I had a chief aboard me. I made chief a couple of times, but I never did get my hat. A little dinghy upstairs, you know, that PTS. Yeah. Oh, God. I've said this before. I never really had anything against the Japanese people. It was the military that was the thing that screwed things up. One thing I never could understand, and I can't understand, but why now they haven't taken a lesson from it. Prior to Pearl Harbor, all this stuff was taking place. They knew something was going to happen. We were on the alert for weeks or maybe even months before that. down there in Pearl Harbor.
You didn't know something was going to happen, but the higher-ups did.
They evidently had, they had to know.
Yeah.
They had to know. I don't think that the president wanted to get into the war for certain reasons. I guess the lend lease, we were making money and stuff and whatnot. This is my way of thinking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about this now, not then.
Yeah, you had no idea then.
I had no idea then.
Yeah.
Who normally would have thought that the Japanese were going to attack here?
Little tiny Japan, that little dot on the map.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember even when I was a kid, we were shipping iron ore and stuff over to Japan all the time.
Sure.
Yep. Yeah. And then they had to expand because they were looking for oil,
mm-hmm.
Burma and all them places like that.
Yep. Yeah, there were a lot of things that pointed toward it, no doubt. Well, you stayed in the Navy for 20 years. You didn't get out till...
I had what they call constructive time. I got out a little early because I had shipped over early.
Uh-huh.
When the war ended, I went to Bainbridge, Maryland as a recruit instructor company commander, and I come out here to the West Coast and started pushing boots. I pushed two companies, and then I went to the Antarctica on Operation High Jump with Admiral Byrd and Admiral...
What was that like?
It was called Operation High Jump.
Uh-huh.
They went down to open up the Antarctic continent again. We went down there with five ships, the Mount Olympus, the Yancey, the Merritt, Submarine Senate, and the Northwind, a Coast Guard cutter, icebreaker.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down to Port Hueneme, and I went aboard the Yancey, AK-93, and then we got our group together and we headed south. Passed by Pitcairn's Island, where the mutineers of the Bounty settled in the Tuamotu Archipelago,
uh-huh.
And headed south, got down and started through the ice. And then we had to send the Submarine Senate back out because she couldn't make it through the ice. And then the Burton Island, the first Navy icebreaker, on a shakedown cruise come in, brought our mail and stuff. There's a big article in the 1947 edition of the National Geographic magazine,
uh-huh.
About the Operation High Jump.
Pretty big piece of history you're a part of there.
Yeah.
Did you...
Digging down through the 40 feet of ice to get the little one of the camps at Little America, shooting the leopard seals for the dogs.
Huh.
I saw that. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I saw that.
I bet you experienced some weather, some temperatures, some conditions that you haven't experienced before or since.
Yeah. The Willie Wars, you couldn't see. It marked the trails with bamboo flags from the shelf ice up to the barrier.
Did you walk outside with any skin exposed at all?
No, you think you wore all that warm clothing, face masks and all. You think if you took a leak, it froze time and hit the deck.
That's a pretty eye-opening experience.
Yeah.
What were you doing during the Korean War?
I was fortunate. I had the Admiral's barge over Treasure Island. That was good duty.
I bet it was.
Yeah.